Last Wednesday evening, we opened up the ultimate can of worms. We went where normal pastors fear to tread, and I don't know why I did that, but we did. I think it's valuable. I'm grateful for the maturity that's represented in this room, because there's no way you can do a study like this with immature people. It's just not, it frankly is impossible, because there's so many other things at stake besides the doctrine of election. What else is at stake is whether or not you actually believe in inspiration, whether or not you are willing to adopt yourself to a proper hermeneutic, whether you're just going to spin verses to make them say what you want to say. There's a lot of other things at stake as well. So I think it's a good exercise, although it'll test everyone for sure. There's no doubt about that. Last week we looked at Ephesians 1. We're not really doing the exegesis of text yet. I'm just trying to build the case for this. Ephesians 1, Paul, right out of the bat, out of the chute in verse 4, says that we have been chosen in him before the foundation of the world. Then he follows that up with a predestination statement in the very next verse, in verse 5, predestinated unto the adoption of sons. And, what are you going to do with those? What are you going to do with that phrase, with the grammar? What are you going to do with the etymology of the words? You got a big decision to make when you're studying Ephesians. What are you going to do with those passages? And the thing is there's at least 50 more where they came from. 50, at least, and actually more if you include the other passages that teach election where that words are not actually used. You got a lot more than 50 actually. So this is not a small area. Anyway, what I want to do is just look at the Lord Jesus' reinforcement of this, just a little smattering of it. Let's turn to Matthew 20, please. The 20th chapter of Matthew. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. Happy is the man that can accept that. Toward the end of his earthly ministry, the Lord started using a phrase that he kept on repeating, evidently. Notice in verse 16, he says, "The last shall be first, and the first last," and then you have a modification of that. By a modification, I mean an heightening of that statement. You have this: "For many be called, but few chosen." Now, there's a lot of theology in that statement. There's actually two calls. There's a general call that God makes to the whole world to be saved. Every person alive has gotten that call, at least through natural revelation. The heavens declare the glory of God. The evidence of creation insists that there is an intelligent designer. And of course, we don't know his name, but that's certainly available to be found out. So many are called. The whole world is called with a general call, but few be chosen. Right, and that call has to do with an efficacious call, which is coincidental with efficacious grace. All right, many be called, but few chosen. Now, the Lord had all kinds of options to use for choice of words there. Right, he could have used the word saints. He could have used the word believers. He could have used any number of synonyms to represent what would become Christianity. But he uses the word for elect. He uses the verb for the word elect. Ekklegomai is the word there, chosen. Look at chapter 22 and verse 14. In a completely different context, the Lord hasn't left that thought yet. 22:14. And here he isolates it, right? "For many are called, but few are chosen." Now, he's saying that in this dispensation, right? That's true of right now in the church age. But the Lord also extends it into the tribulation. So both church age saints and trib saints are elect of God. Say, really, where's that? Well, let's turn over to the sermon on the, it's not the Sermon on the Mount, the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24. I'm just turning some pages here. Matthew 24. Verse 22. Now notice the terminology that Jesus uses to refer to people that will be saved in the tribulation. Don't miss this. Matthew 24:22, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. All right? For the elect's sake. That's the word of choice that the God of heaven used to describe the people saved in the tribulation. All right? Notice verse 24. There shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall grow great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. There it is, his word of choice to describe those who will be saved in the tribulation. So right in the passage of three verses there, you've got the word elect used by Jesus. And if that weren't enough, you've got it again in verse 31. It says, he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together the elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Now, I mean, there's really a whole lot more that we could look at, but I do want to get into the discussion. And what I want to talk about tonight is major on, and again, this is so, it's not dangerous, it's just, it's kind of a frustration because you have to be able to actually hear it all. You know, you can't, you're going to hear something that may sound wrong to you, but you missed the day that we covered that, you see. So just bear with me. I want to talk to you tonight about God's sovereignty and the problem of evil. And I chose my words carefully there. God's sovereignty. Remember, the words God and sovereignty, they're not exact synonyms, but you can't have one without the other. Even pagans do not believe in a God, whatever their conception of God is, that isn't sovereign. That's why they sacrifice to these gods historically. That's why they believe that the gods are in control. And the very concept of God has got to be one who is sovereign. How do you square that with the problem of evil? I mean, that's got to be one of the most difficult questions, is how evil can possibly coexist with a God that's both altogether holy and completely sovereign. And he's completely sovereign, remember, or he's not God. I'm sure that most Christians do not realize how profoundly severe this problem is. It's not a problem to God, it's a problem to us because we're finite creatures. Okay? In fact, skeptics, this is one of the major things that a skeptic will challenge people on. Most skeptics, they latched on to, his name is escaping me now, but they like when this guy called it the Achilles heel of Christianity. This problem of how a sovereign God can allow evil in his world. And I remember, like it was yesterday, the time that I first felt the pain of this thorny problem. I hadn't really ever considered it, frankly, until I had to have a paper due for Dr. William Belshaw, one of the great patriarchs of another day in the GRBC, when the GRBC was a good fellowship. And I had to do this paper on theodicy, which really, really did some mental gymnastics on me, I guarantee you that. But the issue in the paper was simply this. If God is totally righteous, then how could he have created a universe where evil is present? Seems to be a kind of an oxymoron to his sovereignty, not to mention his goodness, right? I mean, if all things come from God, then doesn't it naturally follow that evil comes from him as well? And, that was the first time that I was forced ever, that I can remember, to think about that pretty seriously. I realized that evil, that was a problem discussion, particularly when we compared it to the sovereignty of God. Did evil come into the world against God's sovereign will? And if it did, then he's not absolutely sovereign. You see the catch-22 that you're in? I mean, if not, then we have to conclude that in some sense, even evil is foreordained of God in some way. And, you know, always the most common solution that you hear about this dilemma is basically just that they'll toss out a reference immediately to free will. And we hear statements like evil came into the world by man's free will, and man is the author of sin and not God. And that's correct. I mean, that statement absolutely squares with the biblical account of the origin of sin. We know that man was created with a free will and that man freely chose to sin. mean, it wasn't God that committed the sin in Eden. It was Adam. It was Eve. All right. But the problem doesn't go away. The problem is still there. When I say the word problem, I mean the mental dilemma for finite creatures. From where did man ever gain the slightest inclination to sin? We don't understand the condition that Adam and Eve were created in. We can't comprehend it because that's not us. Okay? If Adam was created with a desire for sin, then a pretty big shadow is being cast then on the integrity of the Maker. If he was created with no desire for sin, which is what the Bible teaches, then we have to ask, all right, where did that desire come from? Where did it come from? The mystery of sin is tied to a lot of things. It's tied to our understanding of free will. It's tied to man's original state in the creation. And it's tied to, ultimately, God's sovereignty. Okay? So the question of free will, it's so vital to our understanding of this whole topic that we're in, election/predestination, that I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to save that for next week. Like, that's my tentative plan anyway. That whole next Wednesday night will be about that. But just introduce it right here. I mean, did you ever think about this? How could Adam and Eve have fallen? I understand how I can fall. That's no mystery to me. How could they have fallen? They were created. The pronouncement of Tov, good, was on Adam and Eve. God looked on everything that he had made and pronounced it good. That was the final assessment of Adam and Eve in their original state. You know, and we might suggest that their problem was the devil and his craftiness. The devil beguiled them. Actually, Adam wasn't deceived at all, frankly. But he did trick the woman into eating the forbidden fruit. And so we might suppose that this snake was so slick that he just utterly and completely bamboozled our original parents. But that explanation suffers from more than one problem, friends. I mean, if Adam and Eve didn't realize what they were doing, if they were so utterly fooled, then the sin ultimately then would have been all of Satan's. It would have been only on him and not on them. Now, that can't be because the Bible makes it very clear that in spite of his craftiness, the serpent spoke directly in challenge to the commands of God. And Adam and Eve, they had heard God. They knew what he said. They fully were in complete understanding of his proclamation, his prohibition, his warning. And they heard with their own two intelligent ears the devil contradict God's words. And the decision now is squarely before them. And they can't appeal to Satan's trickery to excuse them. I mean, even if the devil not only fooled, even if he forced Adam and Eve to sin, we're still not free from this dilemma. You know, I mean, if they could have rightly said, like Flip Wilson, the devil made me do it, then we would still face the problem of the devil's sin. Where did the devil come from? I mean, where did his evil come from? How did he manage to fall from his good state? I mean, whether we're speaking of the fall of man or the fall of the devil, we're still dealing with the problem of a creature that God had pronounced was good, neutral, if you prefer, but now the thing is evil. And again, we hear the easy explanation that evil came through the creature's free will. Now, I'm not belittling free will. Free will, thank God for free will. Free will is a good thing. I mean, that God gave us free will does not cast blame on him. All right? In creation, man was given an alibi to sin. He was given an ability also not to sin. Okay? And Adam chose to sin. And the question that remains is why? Why is that? And that's where the problem lies. Before a person can actually commit an act of sin, he has to first have some kind of inclination or desire to perform that act. And the scriptures tell us that evil actions flow from evil desires. That's what Jesus taught. Out of the heart proceeds horrible things out of the mouth. You know? But the presence of an evil desire is already sin, right? There's adultery in the heart. There's murder in the heart. And we sin because that's what we are. That's what our nature is. We are sinners. We're born with that kind of nature, fallen creatures. Adam and Eve were not created as fallen creatures. We have no idea what that would have been like. They had no sin nature. They were, as God pronounced them, they were good, and they had a free will. And yet, for some inexplicable reason, they choose to sin. Why? I want to know why. And the answer is, I don't know. And I will never know in this life, and neither will you. I don't know. I've never met anybody that can explain that to me, because there is no answer for that. Now, in spite of this excruciating problem, and that is what it is, I think we still have to affirm that God is not the author of sin. I mean, the Bible doesn't reveal the answers to all of our questions. I mean, these are things that we may possibly learn in eternity. What the Bible does reveal, though, is the nature and the character of God. I mean, we can learn a lot about that. And one thing is absolutely, totally unthinkable, and that is that God could possibly be the author or the doer of sin. But we're still left with this question that, given the fact of human sin, how does that relate to God's sovereignty? I mean, if it's true that in some sense God foreordains everything that comes to pass, then it follows without a doubt that God must have somehow, even if it's passively, he foreordained the entrance of sin into the world. Now, that's not to say that God forced sin to happen or that he actually imposed actively evil on his creation. God did not do that. All I'm saying is that God must have decided to allow this to happen in his big understanding of how things are going to be. And if he didn't allow it to happen, then it could not have happened, or else he's not sovereign. So we know that God is sovereign because we know that he's God, you see. Therefore, we have to conclude that his decision to ultimately allow, through his permissive will, sin to enter into the world was something that will ultimately result in the good of them that love him, as crazy as that is. Actually, if you think about it, we get a better deal as Christians, as blood-bought Christians, than Adam and Eve would have had if they had remained sinless. Think about that one. At any rate, I'm not saying that our sin is really a good thing. I'm just here saying that God's allowing us to sin, which is evil, is ultimately not going to thwart him any. Okay? God's allowing evil was part of his genius and his omniscience. But the evil that he allows is still evil. So God's involvement in all of this is 100% righteous. Our involvement in it is 100% evil. And the fact that God decided to allow us to sin, that doesn't absolve us from our responsibility as sinners. If apart from Christ, we would all be still stand condemned, and righteously so. But a frequent objection that you hear is that if God knew in advance that we were going to sin, well, why did he create us in the first place? That's a good question, actually. I mean, one philosopher stated the problem this way. He said, and he stated it in such a way where no matter what answer you give, you're going to implicate God in something, right? He said, if God knew we would sin but couldn't stop it, then he's neither omnipotent nor sovereign. If he could stop it but chose not to, then he's neither loving nor benevolent, right? Well, by this approach, you know, God's made to look bad no matter how you answer the question. So we've got to assume that God knew in advance that man would fall. He always sees the beginning from the end and the end from the beginning. We have to also assume that he could have intervened to stop it, or he could have chosen not to create us at all. Those are all options that were available to him. I mean, we have to grant all those hypothetical possibilities, even though they are just that, they're hypotheticals. The bottom line, I think, is we know that he knew that we would fall, and then he went ahead and created us anyway. Now, why would that mean that he's unloving? You see, that's the accusation of the skeptic, the philosopher. He also knew in advance that he was going to implement a plan of redemption for this fallen creation, and that that would include a perfect manifestation of his justice and an unfathomable expression of his love and mercy. I mean, it was certainly loving of God to predestinate the salvation of his people, these people that Jesus is calling the elect in both dispensations, these chosen ones. But it's the non-elect that are the problem, you see, problem in our mind. If some people are not elected unto salvation, then it would seem that God is not all that loving toward them. And, you know, for them, it seems that it would have been more loving of God not to even have allowed them to be born. And I mean, that may be the case, but we have to ask the really tough questions, like, is there any reason that a righteous God should in any way be forced to be loving toward a creature that hates him continually and rebels constantly against his divine authority and rejects and mocks his holiness? I mean, the objection that's raised by the philosopher implies that God owes his love, right, to wicked people. That really is the unspoken assumption, right? That God's obligated to be gracious to sinners. Well, what that sentiment overlooks is that if grace is obligated, now it's no longer grace. There is no obligation to grace. The very essence of grace is that we have obtained something that is completely undeserved. God always reserves the right to have mercy on whoever he'll have mercy. I mean, God may owe people justice. That would be an obligation, but he never owes anyone mercy. So it's important to point out, I think, once again, that these problems arise for anyone who's willing to accept the Bible as the Word of God, and especially those who believe that God is actually sovereign, that God is actually a sovereign God. All right, for now, so let me say simply that if the final decision for the salvation of fallen sinners was left in the hands of fallen sinners, then I think that we would despair of all hope that anybody really could ever be saved. If the ball was completely passed to man and the ball stayed in man's court, the situation would be hopeless. You know, it's funny to me, and then it makes me mad. You know, one of the greatest arguments against quote unquote Calvinism, I don't like that word at all because I don't have time to explain why I don't like the word, but one of the biggest arguments against that is it negates evangelism. And actually, the understanding that God is sovereign and that he has chosen some people to be saved is actually the opposite. It's one of the greatest motivations there is to get out and to do the Great Commission. It absolutely is. Let me just show you one example. In Acts 18, let's turn there, Acts 18. Okay, if you scan with me through the verses, in verse 1, Paul's leaving Athens, and he lands in Corinth. Corinth becomes one of the, probably, I think it was probably the biggest of all the churches that Paul had founded. But he finds a certain Jew named Aquila there, his wife Priscilla, and they hit it off immediately, and they go into the tent-making business together. They're all there because of the diaspora, and immediately God hooks Paul up with Aquila and Priscilla, and he spends his Saturdays reasoning in the synagogue about the Lord Jesus Christ, He's preaching to both Jews and Greeks, all right? And in verse 5, you have Silas and Timothy. They came down from Macedonia, and Paul is pressed in his spirit, and he wants to witness the Jews, right? And in Romans 9, he tells us about his great passion for the Jews, right? How Christ was actually the real Messiah. And when the Jews are giving Paul a horrible time there in Corinth. Notice it says they blaspheme him and blaspheme God. And so he shakes his raiment out and says, "Your blood be upon your own heads. I'm clean. And from now on, I'm going to stick with the Gentiles like God wanted me to." And so he departs from there and he enters into a certain man's house named Justus in verse 7. And he was a big synagogue guy. Probably he's the one that got Paul in, you know, to gave him a chance to speak. And this guy Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believes on the Lord and his whole family with him. And there's a lot of Corinthians around there, and they're getting saved every weekend through the preaching of the Apostle Paul. That's how the church at Corinth was born. All right, now watch this. Paul, though, sees the opposition. And he's been through hell and back already. And he's afraid. He doesn't want to get whipped again, beaten again, stoned again. And so he probably in his mind thinks, "I'm getting out of here. I did my witnessing in here. I'm going to beat it out of here." And he gets a vision in the night that says, "Don't do it. Stay." Now notice the reason why, verse 10. "I want you to keep doing evangelism." Why? Verse 10. "For I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee." Now watch. "For I have much people in this city." Now what does that mean? Paul just told Paul, "I've got a lot of people that are by my providence in this town that I chose from before the foundation of the world, and all they need is for you to preach to them." That's called motivation to evangelism. Really, it's an amazing thing, friends. Now, when we consider the relationship of a sovereign God to a fallen world, we basically have four options. In fact, if you have a pen on you and a little piece of paper, just write these down real quick, because I'll refer back to them. Number one, God could decide to provide no opportunity for anybody to be saved. Okay, so just write no salvation. That's option one. Option two, God could provide an opportunity for everybody to be saved. All right. Option three, God could intervene directly and ensure the salvation of every person that's ever lived. Okay, or number four, God could intervene directly and ensure the salvation of some. All right, so the choices again. The options are no opportunity for salvation, all right, an opportunity for everybody to be saved, with the implication that the ball's in their court. Thirdly, God could intervene directly to assure that every person born winds up in heaven. And then number four, a direct intervention ensuring the salvation of some. Now, I think all real believers immediately rule out option number one, okay, that there was no opportunity for salvation. And I think most would rule out the third, that God would intervene and ensure that everybody winds up in heaven, a kind of a universalism. All right, so numbers one and three we can eliminate immediately. Okay, and then we face the problem that God saves some and not all. Okay, and we'll call that sovereign grace position, the sovereign grace position. And that answers with a fourth option. All right, the sovereign grace position is that predestination teaches that God actively intervenes in the lives of the elect and makes absolutely sure that they will be saved. Now, all the rest are legitimately invited. It's not a fake invitation. "When come unto me, all ye ends of the earth, and be saved." It's a real invitation, right? The opportunity is there. If they want to be saved, they can be. But sovereign grace assumes that without any divine intervention, no one will ever want to come to Christ. You say, "Is that my idea?" No, the Bible teaches that, friends. It absolutely teaches that. There is no one that seeketh after God. So left to themselves, nobody ever chose Christ. They'll choose some Christ that they invented in their mind, They'll choose something whereby they don't have to repent. I mean, they'll connect themselves to some Jesus thing somehow, but it's just not the Christ of the Bible, and it's not the plan of God in salvation. Now, that's precisely the point of dispute. Okay, let's call these non-sovereignty people Arminians. Arminian views of predestination assume that every fallen person is left with this natural ability to have a propensity toward God, you see. And man's not viewed as being so fallen that he's actually, like the Bible says, he is dead in trespasses and sins, without spiritual life, without any inclination. At least something that would require the direct intervention of God, you see, like life. So the Arminian view, it leaves it all in man's power to cast the deciding ballot for man's ultimate destiny. And in these views, the best option is the is option number two, right? It's now later on we're going to defend a universal atonement, but it's the idea of the, God just puts the ball in man's court, and now man is sovereign about what he's going to do or not do. Okay. Option number two is really the Arminian option. But certainly the opportunities are not equal, friends, because vast multitudes of people die without ever hearing the gospel, frankly. So the Arminian person, the non-sovereign person, objects to this fourth option because it limits salvation, right? Option number four is God intervenes to ensure the salvation of some. Well, they'll say that's God playing favorites. He's limiting salvation to a select group that he chose. Yeah, that's. So the sovereign grace person objects to the second option because he sees this universal opportunity with man in control as not really providing anywhere near enough to secure salvation for anyone. Now, that brings us back to the nasty problem for the sovereign grace guy, which is in the relationship of options three and four. Okay, if God can and does choose to ensure the salvation of some, then why doesn't he ensure the salvation of everyone? Why isn't God a universalist? Now, every Christian, if they're thinking right, if they're honest with the text and they don't want to spin the text, they have to feel the weight of that issue. I do. All right, we face the question, does God have the power to ensure the salvation of everyone? Absolutely he does. He could save every single person on the face of the earth that's walking the earth right now if he wanted to. He could absolutely do that. I mean, if he lacked that power, then he's not God. He's not sovereign. If he has the power, though, why doesn't he use it for everybody's sake? Well, the Arminian guy, he usually responds by saying that, you know, for God to impose his power on unwilling people, well, that violates man's freedom. The favorite word of an Arminian is God's a violator, you see. The Calvinist position is violation. To violate man's freedom is sin, right? And since God can't sin, then he cannot unilaterally impose his saving grace on unwilling sinners. In other words, to force the sinner to be willing when the sinner's not willing is to violate the sinner. That's the thinking of an Arminian. That's not the way it is, but that's the way they think. And so the idea is that by offering the grace of the gospel, that God does everything he can to help the sinner get saved. He has the raw power to coerce men, but the use of that power would be foreign to God's righteousness. I'm telling you how the non-sovereign person thinks. I mean, that does not bring much comfort to the sinner in hell. I mean, the sinner in hell then has to be asking, God, if you really love me, why didn't you coerce me to believe? I mean, I would rather have had my free will violated than to be here in, you know, this eternal hellhole that I'm in. But still, the pleas of the damned, friends, in that case, that would not determine God's righteousness if, in fact, it'd be wrong of God to impose himself on the will of men. So the question that the sovereign grace person asked then is, what's wrong with God creating faith in the heart of a sinner? What's wrong with that? All right, so the question remains, why does God save only some? I mean, if we grant that God can save men by violating their wills, then why then does he not violate everybody's will and make sure that everybody gets saved? And again, I'm using the word violate because that's the word of choice for the Arminians. Okay? The only answer that I can give to that question, friends, is I don't have a clue. And no one else does either. Just like I don't know what caused Adam to sin, I don't have a clue about this question either. And no one ever will, top side of eternity. They never will. I don't doubt for a moment that God has the power to save every person, but I know that he does not choose to save everybody. And I don't have any idea why not. I mean, I may think I do, but I really don't. One thing I do know is if it pleases God to save some and not all, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, we think that there's something wrong with that, but I guarantee you there's nothing wrong with that. God is not under obligation to say, we think that God owed us to be saved. He doesn't owe us nothing. God only owed me hell. That's all he owed me. If he chooses to save some, that in no way obligates him to save all the rest. And so once again, the Bible insists that it's God's divine prerogative to have mercy upon whom he will have mercy, Romans 9. That's the statement of Paul. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. Now, the hue and cry of the sovereign grace person, what you'll always hear at this point is, that's not what? Fair. That's not fair. But what's meant by fairness, I mean, what do you think they mean by that? Why is all of a sudden their concept of fairness violated? What are they really concerned about? Right? I mean, if by fair you mean equal, then the protest is accurate, okay? God absolutely does not treat all men equally. I mean, nothing could be clearer from the Bible than that. I mean, God appeared to Moses in a way that he did not appear to Hammurabi. Did God treat Hammurabi the same way he treated Moses? Obviously not. God gave blessings to Israel that Persia has not received. I mean, Christ appears to Paul on the road to Damascus, but why not Pilate? I mean, obviously men are not created equal that way. He has not treated every human being in history in exactly the same manner. Nobody can deny that. So probably what's meant by the word fair is that's not what? Just. It doesn't seem just for God to choose some to receive his mercy while others are deprived of that benefit. So to deal with that problem, we got to do some really deep thinking, man. I mean, as if you haven't been deep thinking deeply enough tonight, right? Just a little bit longer. Let's assume that all men are guilty in the sight of God. Anybody going to disagree with that? Everybody's guilty, right? Well, from that mass of guilty humanity, God sovereignly decides to give mercy to some of them. And what do the rest get? The elect get mercy. What does everybody else get? They get justice. They get justice, not injustice. The accusation against God that God is not fair is really an accusation God is not just. But if God gives some mercy, all the rest then get justice. They get what they deserve. Okay? They get justice. Nobody gets injustice. God has never been unjust for one second of his existence. Friends, mercy is not justice, but neither is it injustice. Okay? Think of two circles, all right? This circle, let's call this circle justice, all right? And we'll call this circle non-justice, all right? Justice circle, non-justice circle, all right? Can you visualize that? All right, there's those two entities. Non-justice includes everything that's outside this circle of justice, Everything that's not just belongs in this circle. Okay? So in the category of non-justice, you can put two sub-concepts. One would be mercy, because mercy is a non-justice issue. Okay? And the other would be injustice, because injustice is not justice. Mercy and injustice both fall in the circle of non-justice. They're non-justice issues. Now, is your head spinning yet? Are you dizzy yet? Yeah. Mercy is a good form of non-justice, and injustice is a bad form of non-justice. But in the plan of salvation, God doesn't do anything bad or evil. He never commits an injustice. Some get justice, which is what they deserve, and everybody else, like hopefully everybody in this room tonight, you got mercy. Okay, but both of those are non-justice issues because God didn't owe anybody mercy. So again, the fact that one gets mercy, that doesn't demand that the others get it as well, because God deserves the right to reserve to himself executive clemency, you see. By the way, I know you're rebelling against this, but man's free will is still out here. The invitation to come and be saved is still there. If anybody does, God will save them. All right, so let's not, you know, while you're rebelling against the doctrine of sovereignty of God, don't forget that this is still out there, right? I mean, as a human being, I might prefer that God give his mercy to everybody equally, but I can't demand that. Okay, if God's not pleased to dispense his saving mercy to everybody, then I have to submit to his holy and righteous decision, because that's what that is. God has never, ever, ever, this is what we can't understand, friends, because you think you deserve to be saved. God was never under obligation to sacrifice himself so that I could live. Never. That was the decision he made before eternity passed. Somewhere in the eons of the eternal past. But he was not obligated to do that. And that's the point that we have to stress. If we're ever going to ever come close to understanding God's grace, how can you be an Arminian and sing about grace? That's hypocrisy. The real question is why God is inclined to be merciful to anybody, because his mercy is not required. And yet he freely showers the elect with his mercy. You say, no, he didn't. Yeah, he did. You got two boys living in the womb of the same woman. One guy's name is Jacob. The other guy's name is Esau. Jacob have I loved. Esau have I hated. Now, in fairness, the word hated there means that God set his electing love on Jacob. And he let Esau just go his own way. We can't deny that. He gave his mercy to Peter. Well, how about Judas? I don't know why, but that's the way God did it. That's the way God did it. So we have to learn to praise God not only for his mercy, but also for his justice, because that's what makes him good and great. When he executes his justice, he's not doing anything wrong. Nothing. He's executing his justice in perfect keeping with his astounding righteousness. That's what he's doing. All right, now, it's really a tragedy to leave off there, but we have to leave off there because there's so much more to say about free will. We'll major on that next week. And about the universality of the atonement. But, yeah, all right, let's stop for now.